One song, a report on the ELCA Churchwide Assembly in Chicago. And my name is Carol Tomer, I'm the village pastor here, and this is Buzz Kahn. I'll say more about him in a minute. What we wanted to do tonight was try to give you a sense of what happened at this gathering that just concluded very recently. This churchwide assembly was the first biennial churchwide gathering of the new Evangelical Lutheran Church in America since its beginning, January 1, 1988, and it's called churchwide assembly rather than some of our old language of a national convention or something. We have lots of new language in this new church, and there's lots of acronyms I'm learning in the new church, and one is PCB, referring to predecessor church body, and things like national convention now are regarded as PCB language, predecessor church body language. It sounds a little, PCB language sounds a little toxic to me,
yes.
But so beginning with
downright narcotic to me.
Beginning with the right language, the assembly met in Chicago, on the very edge of Chicago, almost adjacent to the location of the new Lutheran Church headquarters, which we're now supposed to call the Lutheran Center, and it's not the national headquarters, it's the churchwide expression or something like that. The meetings were held in the O'Hare Expo Center and the Hyatt Regency O'Hare exposition hall adjacent to a hotel, and they were all very close to O'Hare Airport, very convenient for getting there. There were about, 1,061 delegates present?
It's supposed to be 1,055, but there were 1,041.
Oh, 41. And some observers and many different categories of official observer and invited guests and different folks around. I was one of those observers there for part of the time, in and out. I say that as to explain why I can't report on as much as Buzz can. Buzz Kahn was one of the official delegates from the Northwest Washington Synod, the area that takes in Seattle and places north. So you know that in Washington, this area is divided into 2.5 synods. We've got Northwest Washington, Southwest Washington, and Eastern Washington, Idaho. Holden Village is in Eastern Washington, Idaho Synod. Buzz has been an active lay professional in the Lutheran Church for about 28 years, is that right? And is currently the Director of Outreach and Fellowship Ministries at Cross of Christ Lutheran Church in Bellevue, Washington. He's going to share some reflections on the assembly, and I'm going to add a little bit after that. But just for starters, we thought we'd share a brief summary of some of the things that were decided and acted on at the assembly. And this is basically the summary through everything but the last day, basically. The assembly voted to remain members of the World Council of Churches and the National Council of Churches, adopted a framework for constructing social statements, and elected 96 people to various councils and boards, collected more than $14,000 in special gifts for Namibia. The assembly urged Congress to stop all U.S. military aid to El Salvador and voice support for the Lutheran Church in El Salvador. We expressed concern and support of those who suffer from domestic violence and called for the church to help them with their healing process. We passed a resolution on sexual harassment asking each congregation and synod to study all forms of sexual abuse and draft policies to cope. We approved the continued use of the document called A Statement on Communion Practices. We charged the ELCA Pension, Health, and Dental Benefits Plan We changed the pension, health, and dental benefits plan, including unbundling. which Buzz may want to say more about, but without a $2 million per member limit on total lifetime payments, so that, that $2 million cap was lifted. We approve Mission 90, a program of churchwide renewal in Bible reading, evangelism, and tithing. We voted to divest ELCA funds invested by the Board of Pensions in companies doing business in South Africa by September 1991. We endorsed the celebrations of the 20th anniversary of the ordination of women in the Lutheran Church. We approved the goals for the churchwide communication strategy. We changed the names of 15 synods in the church. We approved the Lutheran Youth Organization Constitution. We recommended that each synod nominate one youth delegate to the churchwide assembly. We approved a resolution on reproductive issues, calling on pastors and congregational leaders to prayerfully consider the issues and to offer personal care, information, counseling, and competent Christian guidance to help couples and individuals explore all the issues. We promised practical and pastoral support for people with AIDS. We adopted a 1990 budget of $102 million and authorized the Church Council to adopt a 1991 budget not to exceed that amount. And we agreed to continue the 55% minimum proportionate share of unrestricted congregational income to be remitted by synods to the churchwide organization in 1990 and 1991. That's a quick once over of almost all that happened. And Buzz, now why don't you go ahead and highlight and share with us some of your reflections about the assembly.
I find people have, some people have very little understanding of how this all comes about, so I just thought I'd back up and let you know how the delegates get selected. Each of the synods in assembly 1988 selected their delegates to the churchwide assembly. And the delegates are based on one delegate for every 6,500 baptized. So, of course, every synod then has a different number of people that participate. Our Northwest Washington Synod, on the basis of its membership in congregations, has 10 delegates plus the bishop. So we were a total of 11, one of whom did not show up among the, 14 people that didn't show up. There's 1,055 delegates, there were 1,041 there. We, those of us that were elected on the basis of certain quotas of male, female, and other than English-speaking backgrounds. So we had with us a delightful contingent with Isaiah Chow, Chinese pastor in Seattle. One of our black delegates was the one that wasn't able to attend. That was really about all of our, I'm going to have trouble starting to think about people now. I won't even try that. Prior to the event, we each received in the mail two books of reports and records, about 300 pages each. Oh no. I only read 300 pages, 560 pages each. And then when I got all done with those and I thought, well, I'm glad I scanned through that material, then this came in the mail without the cover. I had 83 resolutions representing probably over 300 resolutions that had come from synods. Synods in the last 2 years have sent memorials to the national, the churchwide offices, and those resolutions then were compacted where possible, where there were a series of resolutions slightly different, but that they fit one particular issue, then the memorials committee summed them all up and wrote a resolution that came before us. So there were 83 resolutions plus 26 motions that came to the Reference and Council Committee on the floor of the Assembly, coming from various individuals. 8 days, by the way, 8 long days of sitting and doing the business of the church, in the midst of which we had some delightful worship experiences, a lot of fun meeting people, a number of workshops. We were able to attend three different workshops. They really weren't workshops, they were really information events. For example, I attended the one on National Council of Churches. This was prior to the time we took the vote, so those of us that were anxious about that particular issue had an opportunity to hear from people, both Lutherans and others in the National Council, so that we could struggle with those issues. Attended one on the Palestinian-Israeli resolution that was in our material, which I have a particular interest in. Then there was 175 pages of this, these changes in the pension and medical program. Don't ask me, okay? I can't say I studied that material very carefully, but it's all there in print. And that, of course, is in reference to the pension and medical program for clergy and associates in ministry. If you haven't caught up with that language yet, those of us who were either lay professionals in the predecessor body known as LCA or church staff workers in the predecessor ALC or teachers and deacons, deaconesses in AELC and others, we now were lumped into the category of associates in ministry. And associates in ministry, along with clergy, are in the pension and medical program of the church. The things that were exciting, I'll share with you first, that is exciting for me, that may not have been for everybody. The bishop's report. Herb Chilstrom is a delightful man. He's an excellent leader. He is a gentle person with just a tremendous heart and mind, I think, in good balance. And he presented to us Mission 90. And I've summarized Mission 90 on the board. There are three dimensions to it. And those of you that attended Dan Bruner, Dan here?
Yep.
Those of you that attended Dan Bruner's session this afternoon, this morning, and caught the dimensions that Dan gave between the differences between replacing and
restoring.
And restoring. I think what Herb Chilstrom has done for us in this Mission 90 presentation is to do both, and you'll be able to see how that works out. See, grow, and serve are the key words to Mission 90. You'll be hearing lots about it in the Lutheran and the materials that will be forthcoming. He wants us to see what it means to be Christian through Bible reading and study, through daily prayer and reflection. And we don't have to wait till 1990 to do that, but in the fall of 1990, the new revised standard version of the Bible is going to come out. And Bishop Chilstrom thinks it would be an ideal time for us to all together be studying the same text. I don't know if he's getting a commission for the new Bibles that are going to be sold or not, but I didn't accuse him of that. But anyway, that particular phase will help us to focus on scriptural passages, to study across the country together throughout the ELCA, and there will be reading materials, study materials that will be produced by next fall to help us to do that. The second item is to grow in our witness, the realization that if we don't soon become an evangelical church, there won't be much left. As Dr. Preuss used to say, the boats quit coming from Scandinavia and Germany a long time ago. Mm-hmm. We keep hearing the figures of how much loss every year we have. So witness becomes very important. The item under giving. Dr. Chilstrom is convinced that we need to have at least 1 million tithers in the church, and that then we can realize all of the things that everybody in the church wants to have happen. And there is going to be a program that will start soon to encourage congregations to gather around that particular cause and thought, to join those of you that are already tithing to see to it that there are at least 1 million, that is at least 20% of our membership that are tithing, and then to continue in the area of diversity. One of the most exciting things I told Carol for me at the assembly was to see the color of the ELCA. There were a number of things that helped to do that. One, of course, was the quota that we now have. There was more than 10% color there. Lots of blacks, Chicanos. We had people of East Indian background. We had Puerto Ricans. It was just delightful to be in the presence of a great amount of multicultural, which is what this whole business of diversity is focused on. So we had a lot of color, a lot of people involved in worship with heavy accents of various kinds, with varying colors of complexion from the Orient to, as I say, India. That was just exciting for me. When the 70 Namibian students who following the assembly were being scattered to our universities and colleges all over the country. If you're not aware, we started out, 3 years ago? I think 3 years ago we started out with about 30 Namibian students. Keeping in mind, Namibia has no college or university. It is about 90% Lutheran. And so those black students are coming to the States under our sponsorship. Congregations like yours and mine that are contributing money for them to go to school here. We are now up to 70. The hope is in 2 more years we'll have 90. But almost all of those students have just come from orientation, and they came marching and singing into the assembly hall. And I'll tell you, that was a chilling, chilling, delightful experience. They shared with us in music and in some of the testimonies that they had. And it's just neat to see that these people will return to their home country in 1, 2, or 3, or 4 years, having learned at our Lutheran schools what it means to be Christian and what it means to be educated. So that was exciting. We saw a film about shadows and light, and you'll have an opportunity to get one in your congregation to see. It's about a 20-minute, 25-minute film. And towards the end of the film, there's this delightful scene of this black African pastor serving a two-point parish in, guess where? North Dakota. And the love affair of that man and his parish just brought tears to everybody's eyes. And then I heard about the 16-year-old black girl from a little church in Texas who went to San Antonio for the Lutheran League convention last summer. And when she got there, she gasped and she said to her sponsor, "I didn't know there were whites in the Lutheran church." So we are a new church, and I think it has exciting dimensions to it because of the deliberateness with which we are pursuing a multicultural church. I heard a Presbyterian Church of Christ and Congregationalists who were involved in the NCC meeting commending the ELCA as the only church, the only Protestant church that has deliberately made an effort and set a quota and is pushing itself into multicultural dimensions. That came as a very strong compliment from those people who pointed that out. Also for me was the excitement of faithful people, even people I didn't agree with, even people I was angry at for what they stand for. That's one of the great things about being part of an assembly gathering like that, is to discover the diversity and yet at the same time to discover how many faithful people we have in our church. I know it's easy for us to sit back and say, "Is he really a Christian? Or are they too political?" or whatever the kinds of criticisms we have, some of which we listed on the board this morning in Dan's class. But it's just neat to find so many people who are in love with the Lord and in love with the church that he has provided for us. Negatives. Had the feeling it's an unwieldy bureaucracy. That's frustrating, to try to do business for the church and discover that what I thought was an issue that had maybe one or two or three sides to it wound up having 15 or 20, and no time or ability to really know what is right and what is wrong on a specific issue. And then realizing that there are 90 more issues to come, and the sudden discovery that there's probably 20 different sides in each one of those. So it becomes an overwhelming task of trying to do the business of the church, and of course that business becomes increasingly diversified because of the diversity of the family. And that presents a real problem. Because we are more diverse, we have more diverse opinions about what should be done about everything from South Africa to Palestine, Israel, to divestment in the pension program, to reproductive issues, to abortion, to homosexuality in the church. You know, this whole panoply of things to deal with. And fortunately, we didn't have to deal with all of those that we anticipated were going to be horrifying because they were put off for studies to be done by 1991 or 1993, the next two.
Was it done on the seventh day?
The seventh and eighth day get very frightening because yes, all of a sudden you've got half of the resolutions and half of the memorials before you, and you know you can't complete them. And fortunately at that point the committees responsible for that reference and council begin to package them together. We've got a half a dozen memorials here that deal with this particular issue. You want to take them in block and deal with them. And then you've got to decide whether you want to pull them out of the block and fight over one of those 6 or 10 or 12 or how many there might be. I was tempted at one point to do that, and then I didn't. And then I discovered it wasn't in the block after all. And I'll share something of that with you later, maybe. Lyle Scheller, Dan quoted this morning as saying, one of the dangers of a large church is losing identity. In a setting like that, it's very clear that ALC people, LCA people, AELC people have lost something in the process. On the other hand, you gain a lot in the process, but there is definitely a sense of loss of identity that takes place, I think, just as it was in 1961, 59, 60, 61, when you lost whatever it was you came into the church with. Again, the diversity multiplies the decisions and the problems, and what I would say are the incapacities to taking action on some issues. And that's when I suppose all of us, if we look at the issues at one point or another, get a little peeved with who's making the decisions, who chooses the issues, and who sets the priorities. Who manages behind the scenes political movement that results in what comes to the floor of an assembly, and what issues manage to get swept aside or dealt with very quickly are those that get hashed and rehashed. The anticipations were that the World Council of Churches, the decision about membership of World Council of Churches and National Council of Churches of Christ were going to be two of the major debate items on the floor, neither of which turned out to be. The World Council of Churches vote, I don't think there was a speaker on the floor other than in support of, and the vote, I think, was almost unanimous. National Council of Churches for Christ, there was a little debate on that, but not nearly what people expected, and I think that's because of the very fine job that was done by the panel at the workshop. The panel included, I think, 4 of our ELCA people that serve in the National Council of Churches, and the president of the NCC, and 2 of the top officials. They did an excellent job of fielding the questions and the angry counters and what have you, just did an excellent job, so that went through, I would say, 90% or more of the assembly voted. The divestment thing brought up lots of discussion because there seems to be some difference as to what divestment really does to the African blacks and how they suffer, the blacks and the colored. and whether they suffer because we pull money out or not. And that seemed to have been quite well resolved, that at least most of those who speak in favor of divestment that speak from South Africa and suggest to us that we totally divest seem to be have more substantiation for the evidence that blacks would rather be living in poverty and have freedom, if that's a possibility, than to have a little more money because we haven't divested. Mary and Jean Carter from Congregation came up with me, and they brought the Bellevue American along with them on Saturday. And the heading is, New Lutheran Assembly Finds Much to Debate. I'm tempted to read a little bit of that, but Carol, why don't you respond or react to add, subtract, delete, whatever.
Well, I just want to add a little bit before, I think maybe a little more elaboration on a few issues might be helpful. Speak to this experience of being an observer at the assembly. My experience being there is that it was very hard to be an observer of the assembly, and that didn't feel good for me, for that to be the way we as a church-wide gathering are handling ourselves. And one of the problems with that is that stack of paper that the delegates got, the observers did not get. It was not made available for us. So when debates would be going on about point A and a certain resolution, we didn't have a clue what was going on. And I found that to be an interesting irony in an assembly that cared a lot about inclusivity, as you heard Buzz talk about already, that we were good on certain issues of inclusivity and in balancing the makeup of the delegation, but in not being very inclusive of the observers and inviting them into understanding what was going on. Similarly, I would say some of the worship experiences, there were not the worship booklets available for the observers some days until later on in the assembly they made some available. Another issue I would raise as a kind of disappointment of the assembly is the worship experiences. They were festive and wonderful, but on one count I was disappointed, and that is that this is the booklet of the services. Almost no attempt was made in any of the services to address the issue of inclusive language. Almost not a word was changed from traditional services. In other words, alternative settings of liturgy, some new liturgies, but the text that was used was the traditional Lutheran Book of Worship language, which in many points is not inclusive in its references to God. Rather is all male in references to God. And that was a concern to me, since I think the church has said that we care about inclusive language. Just yesterday I led a session about inclusive language and shared with people a new publication that has come out from the ELCA regarding guidelines for inclusive language use in writing and speaking about people and about God. And those guidelines were wonderful. But none of those guidelines that are put out by the ELCA were followed in the worship that was led at the assembly. And I think we need to continue to raise those issues. And another issue I would raise as concern is observation of the cost of the assembly. Buzz pointed out, well, we've read in the Lutheran that the cost of the assembly was like $1.6 million or so, and there were 1,041 delegates. Clearly there's some other costs besides the cost of delegates, but if you divide that down, that means that the cost per delegate was about $1,400, which, well, delegates' travel was paid for, their housing and their meals to the tune of $26 a day is what they were given as a guideline, which at first I thought, boy, that's kind of high, but not really when you're staying in an expensive hotel and you're, I understood from delegates, they were expected to spend a certain amount of their daily food costs in the hotel, or else the hotel would charge for the use of some of the meeting rooms. Well, of course, the charges at the O'Hare Regency, Regency O'Hare were exorbitant. And I think we need to, you know, at the same time we're talking about budget problems in the ALCA, perhaps looking at some other ways of having assemblies. There was some discussion among some delegates about meeting at a Lutheran college, for instance, this time. Well, we know 2 years from now, the next assembly will take place in Orlando, Florida. I don't know how that site was chosen. It was simply announced. And 2 years after that, the site will be Kansas City. But I think clearly these gatherings are not easy things to pull together, and it's real easy for us to second-guess costs and choices that are made. But we do have some cost concerns, and I think issues of stewardship are really pertinent at these points.
Let me pick up on that inclusivity for a moment, too. There were about 50 high school youth as observers, and I know they just did some excellent things in terms of what they were working on, but towards the end of the session, they brought a resolution, and their resolution was, we want to be voting delegates. And what then does that do to the whole structure of how we select our delegates and quota system and everything else? So they felt also like second-class citizens, that they should have been participants in the whole process. By the way, that there were some beautiful things they did. At one point, the high school kids did a presentation for all of us, and David Ranking, 16 or 17-year-old, good-looking boy, totally blind, vice president of our Lutheran youth organization, churchwide, shared his story. And he said, I have felt, and I have no idea how long he was blind, was he blind from birth or what, but he said, in my years in junior high and high school, I have not felt like doing anything. I have not had any hope or dream. I have not felt good about life, very negative. And then he said a miracle happened. And he said the miracle is called Luther League. Kids in his church surrounded him, kept pushing him into leadership roles, recognizing gifts that he has, took him to San Antonio for the convention, and pushed him into running for vice president, which he was elected to. And he said, I now have dreams, I have hopes, I see myself as having potential, and some sense of self-worth. Tears, beautiful, absolutely beautiful. We got some beautiful kids who are the church of today and will be the church of tomorrow. We just saw a few of them in action there. You have them in your parishes too. And they just need some affirmation and encouragement and opportunity, like they.
One exciting thing that I hope grabs hold that I saw was that all the delegates present were given in their many, many materials. They all carried these, we could tell the delegates, they carried these big satchels around filled with stuff. Was a green plastic cover spiral notebook with hymns in it. It's a new publication available from Augsburg Fortress. It's like a hymnal supplement. I don't know how many hymns were in there, maybe 30 or 40. Both new hymns and hymns that never made the LBW but were from predecessor hymnals. I guess that'd be mostly the red hymnal. And that Augsburg Fortress is going to put out additional collections of these hymn supplements, for example, collections of Hispanic hymns or other kinds of hymns that then congregations can choose from. Maybe that particular collection of Hispanic hymns would be good in a certain congregation, and other congregations need something else. And I like that approach to a hymnal because I think it's very adaptable and flexible to the particular needs of our certain context, and I think could really invite the use of alternative worship resources in a very ongoing, flexible kind of way. I hope you can all kind of look for that as as a way to approach some of your particular worship needs where you're at. Want to say something about maybe the NCC debate or some of the potential maybe that we're casting?
Want to see first if we have some questions?
Okay. Questions at this point, yeah.
What changes did you say were being made in the pension plan?
Oh boy.
I'll give the easy answer.
You give the easy okay. I didn't know there was one.
The easy thing to say is simply that the cap was lifted on lifetime medical payments. Before it was $2 million, that you could not go beyond $2 million of medical expenses in a lifetime that insurance would cover, the ELCA plan. That cap was lifted. I guess now it's unlimited. That's the easy part to talk about. Unbundling is the complicated part.
And the reason for the lifting of the limitation was the reality that people my age, that probably wouldn't make a lot of difference. I'd just soon pull the plug if it got to that point. But for young clergy and young associates of ministry who perhaps have a child that's born with some malady that's requiring a constant outflow of money for hospital care, well, some of you know how quick you can go through $2 million. The objection to that very clearly was nobody knew of any other insurance program, any other medical program that provided an unlimited amount. Take a look at your policies. You probably have a $1 or $2 million cap on yours. So that was the other end of that stick, and how that threw the whole plan out of kilter, because that was not what the pension committee or the pension board brought to us. That was raised on the floor. So I'll give you a little idea how the democracy works. That was not part of their plan, and that was voted into through a lot of debate on the floor. The unbundling thing is that because we have so many more clergy couples or couples at working in the church, or where we have so many more working spouses, that, for example, if you work for a school district and you have complete insurance and your spouse is a clergy person and has complete insurance, your spouse who's with the ELCA program is paying, your church is paying for you. And to unbundle meant that you could then be disconnected from that as a spouse. And that would reduce the congregation's payments to the program. Now the problem with that is that congregations that are wealthier pay their staffs more, and that offsets the total amount of money that goes in, offsets those congregations that are poorer and do not pay even a median level. Some of you represent congregations that are paying maybe a third of the actual cost for the insurance for your clergy or associated ministry. And then some of our congregations are paying two or three times or four times more than your little parish is. So the unbundling was not without its problems, because then they had to figure in all of this other business, how they're going to cover the cost. Nothing simple.
It's an equally complicated facet of the whole pension plan. At one time in the ALC, the pension plan monies were invested in such a way that when talk about disinvestment or divestment of funds, they said that they were legally held to those particular investments. They couldn't liquidate them because of the regulations imposed by
right.
The pension plan.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Was anything clarified?
Yes.
On this present plan,
the assembly voted that the pension board is to disinvest and or divest at every point that they can by a specific date. And two lawyers rose to the microphones to say, "You probably can't do it." Because investments are made through stock brokerage offices, the state of Illinois has limitations as to what you can do to pull out of stock packages. So I don't understand it all, but it's probably going to come to that September date of 1991, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Probably going to come to that September date, and we are going to be notified that in spite of the wishes of a majority of those at the assembly, that legally it cannot happen. Because of the...
I just hope for Archbishop Tutu understands that.
John, and then Robert, and then Dan.
Was any decision made on early communion? Communing children?
Yes, the decision was made to continue using the current policy on communion practices, and there already is a study committee that is looking at further changes. The issue of child communion for small children, young children, was brought to the floor, and its very apt spokesperson, Eric Gritsch, did a good job of addressing that. That was not, the amendment that he brought was not accepted, because it was referred again back to the committee that's doing the study on communion. If you're not aware of the fact, there are clergy persons in the ELCA that are communing infants and children for some very good reasons. You leave your children sit in the other room while you have a meal. Trust that you bring them to the table with you and that you all eat together. Where did we ever get the business of keeping kids from the communion rail? We tied confirmation to communion and said, until you're instructed in the faith, you can't receive. Of course, that changed a few years ago, and we lowered the age to fifth grade, and then some congregations lowered it even further. And there are those who are saying, if we really believe what we say about baptism, that one is a full-fledged member of the family of faith in baptism, then how can you set that person aside to say you can't receive the body and blood? So that issue is a live one, and we won't have to decide that because it's now in the hands of a study committee to come with a recommendation, I think, in 93.
Oh, is it that one?
Mm. Maybe 91.
And I would add that the same just happened at the assembly of the Canadian Lutheran Church this summer. It was brought as a proposal and then was referred back for study some more. And I think in a lot of parishes it's becoming an increasingly hot issue. Yeah.
Along the same line of communion, our church has really been very good about ecumenical studies. Was anything said about ecumenical type communion services? We've been fudging on that from the start of this church, and I know in the predecessor churches there was a lot of fudging on that too. What was said, or if anything, about that?
I don't know.
We have a large statement on ecumenism, very well put together, I think, in terms of the whole gamut of involvement from an ecumenical standpoint. We are a church now committed to ecumenism, but that particular subject is not dealt with to any lengthy degree because of the continuing dialogues going on with Reformed churches, Methodist churches, and many of the others. So until those dialogues are completed, no decision can be made overall. Good material, well written.
Wait, let's finish with this. Let's see. Okay. So, John, Robert.
I don't want to change the subject if somebody wanted to continue.
Is this on the same subject?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is there a statement upon invitation to the table of what my own pastor does have a statement that he makes? And I wonder if this is a rule, or can you invite everybody and anybody in the congregation
Do you have a copy of the statement?
No, I don't. And I don't know how you understand the statement, but I understand it to be something that congregations can decide how they're going to handle it. The statement is guidelines, pretty much?
Statement is guidelines for congregational use. So you ask your pastor for the statement, or maybe put together a study group in your parish that looks at that material.
Some churches have used a kind of an interim policy as they've been dealing with this of saying that if children come to the congregation, they've moved in and they were from a congregation where they were being allowed to commune as children or infants, then they can commune in that new parish. But of course you can see the problem with that, because then their friends get sent away from the table and they're communing. So
well, the statement in my church is generally, if you have been baptized and believe that you are receiving the body and blood of Jesus Christ who died for you, that is the general statement. So I'm not really talking about infants or someone like that within the church. I'm talking, although it applies, also to all, because of this ecumenical question that just came up. Someone comes to your church and visits. If there's no statement at all people can come up. And there's still decision because of studies going on between these different churches. That's, but you answered my question, that guidelines are given to the congregations only. Mm-hmm. And they make the decision who they serve.
Mm-hmm. That's my understanding of it. Robert?
I've been reading Cost of Discipleship by Dietrich Bonhoeffer recently, and I was struck by something that was said, and then I'm going to kind of read this in case I get the quotation wrong. One of the chapters, he quoted that Luther reckoned that suffering among the marks the true church, that suffering marked the true church. And one of the memoranda drawn up in preparation for the Augsburg Confession defines the church as the community of those, in quotation marks, who are persecuted and martyred for the gospel's sake. And looking at that statement, I thought, well, you can look at some of the churches, the Black Christian Church in South Africa, as certainly being a suffering church, but maybe therefore a true church. And perhaps in El Salvador and Nicaragua and places like that. And I wondered if you would view the ELCA as a suffering church or not.
8 days in a hotel in Chicago.
Thank you.
That's expensive suffering.
Luther said it was the true church, one of the marks of the true church.
I've heard it said that if the people in our churches ever found out what the church was all about, they'd quit showing up. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many of us would want to participate in a suffering? How many of us would be willing to participate in a suffering church? Now, if suffering comes to us, if oppression comes to our church, to the church in this country, then I suppose some of us are going to opt out, some of us are going to hang in there and suffer with the best of them, huh? What do you do when you're not in a suffering church? Do you look for ways to suffer?
Yeah.
And how do you do that in our culture? Would tithing be a way of suffering? I suspect for some people that they would consider that to be true. We have people in our parishes who are giving 20, 30, 40% of their income. I suppose some of us would look at that and say, boy, if I did that, I'd really be suffering. I don't know how to answer beyond that, Robert.
without trivializing, it would seem, without trying to trivialize the pain and suffering that goes on in South Africa and the third world countries, I think there is also genuine suffering going on in our churches today. Abuse, spouse, child abuse, the pains of alcoholism, divorce, emotional stress. I don't want to say that these kinds of suffering are equal to the suffering of people who don't have enough to eat. And I don't want to say that. At the same time, I would say it is suffering, and that the church, as part of its calling, and I appreciate what is pointed out from Bonhoeffer, as part of its calling, needs to recognize, as it seems it has from the resolutions that you've mentioned, the suffering that does exist in our own country, in a very valid sense.
But the church body as a whole in the United States is not being persecuted as it is in other countries. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I've interpreted what Luther and Bonhoeffer said, but was that the persecution that comes because you're a Christian, not the pain that you go through because of the individual happenings in your life. I personally go on record as saying I don't think that the ELCA is a suffering church.
I would agree with the distinction you've made there. And I think it's a very important question for North American Christian churches to ask. Are we that kind of suffering church? Or have we cozied up with the culture so much that the church and the culture cannot be distinguished from each other?
It seems to me in that third point, which you didn't talk much about, to serve, if we serve these causes of peace and justice, there's going to be some suffering just to serve in these areas.
Thanks. I don't know why I left that off. That certainly is a very major part of that Mission 90, that we would serve by seeking remedies and involvement in the causes of peace and justice and the care of creation, the environment, and the formation of partnerships, of congregations. The bishop's going to ask you and your congregation to partner up with a foreign country congregation and to be more than just a prayer partner, but to be somehow involved economically, financially, in ways with a foreign country. And also to partner up with a ministry, with one of the many ministries that ELCA is involved in. That may be, for those of us in the Western Washington area, the Compass Center, or the Luther Child Center, but to partner up in ministry so that we again are providing both help in terms of persons, human resources, as well as financial help.
Dan, was that your comment?
No,
okay,
no.
Now we get to your hand.
Mine has to do with I sense, at least in the Pacific Northwest, it's a fairly high controversy, and I don't know if it came up, but the study in ministry that is going into place right now.
You don't know what you're asking, Dan.
I do know what I'm asking, but I don't know where you stand.
Oh, my button gets punched at that point.
It would appear to me that there is a double standard within the Lutheran Church for clergy and for associated ministry and lay people, in that the lay people are going to be asked to be recertified, and that no clergy person is being asked to be reordained or recertified.
What Dan is referring to is that among the lay professionals and church staff workers in the past, we have had a certification program. And when the new church was formed, something happened between the design of the interim programs and how they finally came to us constitutionally. People who were involved in the committee that set up that program for lay professionals did not intend what finally came into the Constitution, and then it was too late to do anything about. We have been disenfranchised at the Synod level. Some of us have voice and vote at Synod assemblies. That is, some of us who are non-ordained professionals. We are now can only have 10% of our legitimate voting members voting at Synod assemblies. So we felt disenfranchised, plus the fact that we were told that we would have to be recertified. Well, what this comes out of, and this you may know about this, between the two major synods that merged, we have two totally different understandings of ministry. When the Swedes came to this country and the Germans, who formed congregations? The clergy. They came to this country for the purpose of forming congregations. And in order to support each other, they formed synods so that they would meet once a year as representatives of their synod. Who? The clergy. Because they were the ones who created the congregations and developed the congregations. The Norwegians and the Danes and a few Germans came over, were called for. Remember, congregations formed in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, and they wrote home and said, send us a pastor. The congregations were responsible for their formation. When they formed synods, they were delegates from the lay people in the parish to the synod. See what we got? We got two totally different backgrounds into this new mix called ELCA. And those that have this higher perspective of clergy, and unfortunately not quite so high an image of the non-ordained professional, have said those people are not ministers of word and sacrament. And they insist that we only have one form of ministry. The way we've been functioning in the ALC and in the AELC, we have said, no, we have at least two forms of ministry besides all of the laity. We have clergy, and then we have we who function like deacons or deaconesses or like teachers in the Missouri Synod, which AELC was part of. And that segment that came out of the PCB known as LCA said they would have nothing to do with this new church. You remember the bishops walked out. The LCA bishops walked out of one of the meetings over that issue. We only have one form of ministry. Now the study on ministry that is in its second, third year, and it's supposed to be a six-year study on ministry. That study on ministry is to determine what ministry is. We don't know in the Lutheran Church what ministry is. And so they're going to have to determine that. And one of the pressures of that is the Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry document that is part of the ecumenical thing. If we are going to try to fit in with our Catholic and other Protestant brothers and sisters into a definition of ministry, their definition, for the most part, says there are three. Okay? There are clergy, word and sacrament. There are deacons and deaconesses, which would be us non-ordained professionals, and all of the laity. So that's what we're up against at this point.
And for those of you who are from the Northwest, you know that all of us know that there's going to be these meetings of the study of ministry folks around the country getting people's opinions. And there's a meeting in Seattle on October 2nd, and these are open for you to come participate. They want to hear from people what their concerns are. October 2nd at St. John's Lutheran in Seattle, and October 3rd in Olympia, and I don't know off the top of my head.
They're in the latest Lutheran, has them all.
I think October 4th in Salem, Oregon.
Let me just tell you about Paul Nelson. Dr. Paul Nelson, a clergy person who was selected by the board for ministry to head up that task force He is something else. This man has, he's got some of the hardest-headed folks you could ever imagine to deal with in this study, some of whom are bishops, and some of whom are theologians from our seminaries, who have made up their minds what ministry is long time ago. Paul ain't gonna let them. And he is doing everything to keep them from coming to any conclusions. He is having them study everything from the historical background of ministry, from the beginning of the church, with all kinds of theological material, all kinds of practical material, all kinds of input from other denominations. And he simply pushes on those folks that they are not going to make up their minds until the study is complete as to what they are going to recommend to the church. With Paul at the helm, some of us have some hope that it's going to be really a study that's going to represent the whole church. And you can participate in that by plugging into one of those.
I would encourage events. You to. It should be noted that Region 1 is one of the most boisterous.
Boisterous, did you say?
Boisterous, angry.
Oh, you betcha.
Outspoken.
That's because we've had probably had more lay associates, lay professionals, and have been recognized by the clergy and the laity in the what was the North Pacific District of the ALC to the degree that's far beyond what has happened in the rest of the country. It's our clergy. And a lot of our laity who are fighting for those of us who were disenfranchised and told we have to be recertified. They are the ones who won't let us quit pushing, and they're pushing for us. And that's a delightful kind of a thing to have. Not all of them.
I just was not aware of that at all.
Well, you don't need to be if you're not one of us.
But as a clergyman, I would be on your side, really.
Good. We've got a lot of.
Because the ministry of the church, each one of us, regardless of our status within the congregation, each one of us is a minister, whether we like it or not, whether we act like it or not. It's simply the professional, it's simply doing some of the things that the congregation's behest. So, as Paul says, everyone doesn't have a different hymn to sing or a different song to read or something like that, but we have some order and so forth to be in the church. So I can't see where they get off on saying that they're disenfranchised.
Well, we can do clergy bashing. We did some of that this morning. Every time we get involved in clergy bashing, I think it's time for the laity to take a good look at themselves. Anytime you're inclined to be critical of your clergy. And some years ago, I heard this description. I jotted this down this morning, Dan, in the midst of your session. People in our congregations, it has been said, consider God the director or coach, and the pastor is the actor, and the people are the critics. And the truth is that the pastor is the director coach, and the people are the actors, and God's the critic. I think we quite often, we as laity, really confuse that. If clergy have too high a view of themselves, it's probably because we've given them all the responsibility and not adequately taken the responsibility as the priesthood of all believers. Maybe they aren't anxious to give it to us because we don't do it very good and we're not very willing. So anytime you want to get involved in clergy bashing, take a look in the mirror and question what you are doing to contribute to the ministry that you've been called to.
I'm aware of the time.